Welcome back to Series 11 of the Great Women Artists podcast. It's great to have you back, and do we have an exciting series for you. But just before we get to this, I am so excited to say that this series is supported by the Levitt Collection, a vast and varied art collection of which a major portion is dedicated to works by women artists. Christian Levitt's support for women in the arts is such that after publishing the major book Abstract Expressionists, The Women, in 2023, he will soon be opening the first private museum in Europe entirely dedicated to female artists on the 21st of June 2024 in Mougins, near Cannes, in the south of France. FAM, standing for Female Artists of the Mougins Museum, will unveil to the public over 100 works created by more than 80 female artists from around the world. The museum will exhibit a breathtaking array of incredible artworks from the Levitt Collection, including paintings, sculptures, and photographs by top women artists who have marked the major artistic movements from the 19th century to the present day. Opening on the 21st of June, tickets are now on sale at www.famm.com. And in the meantime, stay tuned at fam_Mougins. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Great Women Artists podcast with me, Katie Hessel. Some of you might know me from The Great Women Artists, an Instagram account I set up in October 2015, which celebrates female artists on a daily basis, ranging from young graduates to old masters. Well, in a similar fashion to the Instagram, this podcast is all about celebrating female artists from a variety of backgrounds and histories. And I'm so excited to be interviewing artists on their career, or artists, writers, curators, or general art lovers on the woman artist who means most to them. What I want this podcast to do is celebrate female artists in all different capacities, so you, the listener, can gain a look into the greatest female artists working now or from art history. I am so excited to say that my guest on the Great Women Artists podcast is one of the most exciting artists working in the world right now, Rose B. Simpson. An artist working across mediums that span sculpture to performance, painting and ceramics, Simpson is hailed for her life-size clay figures, which she adorns with a plethora of symbols, extended antennas and materials, from steel, beads, leather and wood. She challenges the nature of sculpture in ways, as she has said, that can transform my own reality, and her figures appear to be imbued with spirituality. They can have titles like Genesis, Guides, Heights, and Vital Organ, accentuating the importance of the body and rituals. Simpson was born and lives and works in Santa Clara, Pueblo, New Mexico, and grew up in a multi-generational matrilineal lineage of artists working in clay, including her mother. Her practice is informed by indigenous tradition. As she has said, the work represents my own journey, whether it is a psychological investigation or a new spiritual awareness or practical. A recipient of a BFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts, an MFA in ceramics from Rhode Island School of Art and Design in 2011, and another MFA in creative nonfiction from the Institute of American Indian Arts, storytelling, history, and making seem to be at the center of her practice, something she has expanded on further with her artwork Maria, a black-on-black lowrider 985 Chevrolet El Camino. An artwork named in honor of her Native American artist, Maria Martinez, which sits at the heart of her community in Española Valley. And I can't wait to find out more. Rose B. Simpson, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Katie. I'm good. Happy to talk to you.
Thank you so much for being here. I have been enamored by your work for a while. I was lucky enough to see your sculpture Heights 1 at the De Young Museum in San Francisco, this androgynous human-formed figure who stands tall and proud with an antenna that almost alludes to this idea of an infinite spiritual growth, as if signaling its knowledge and wisdom. So much of your figurative work based on our bodies is entrenched in this symbolism and the external armor that can symbolize what looks like wisdom or spirituality. They feel so powerful, like protectors, ancient and universal. So I'd love to start off by asking you, how do you hope for people to feel in front of or engage when they are confronted by your work?
When I'm building the work, I'm in a state of wonder and investigation. In my feeling state, right? So I am navigating the steps forward through a deep attention to different source of witness and different source of perception, because we're so stuck with our eyes and our ears and even our mind, right? My practice is very much about looking for other ways to listen. And I believe that when things are made in a certain way, that they will inform others in how to perceive them, right? And so I hope that when people perceive the work, that they are also being sent to a different type of witnessing.
I think so. And how do you, I guess, access that kind of power when you are making?
I don't know. I ask myself that question a lot. I think there's been times where I've wondered what that means and what that looks like. And so often we try to put things in controllable boxes of this means that and this means this. And I try to take things out of those boxes. I don't get to the point of growth if I'm constantly in my state of control. But that control is my comfort zone. It's my safety. It's that I return to over and over again. And so it's that pushing myself out of that comfort zone and that controlled existence. I think that's where I find those new ways of witnessing. It's like asking myself, is there another way that I can approach this? And then listening, because we always have answers for ourselves. And oftentimes those answers are pretty depressing and ugly. But if we listen in a different way, I think that there's answers that come in the sort of silence and a deeper source of witness.
You work with a plethora of materials, but I'm particularly drawn to your sculpture. What does sculpture and its potentials allow for? You've talked about this idea that they can be tools that can also cure.
I return to sculpture. I really, really love two-dimensional work. I love graphic design. I like when things have limits because then I have to be more innovative and creative. And so I'm very caught by two-dimensional work. I'm caught by literature, fiction and nonfiction, and the limits that those sort of create, and then the limitlessness in those limits, and how we learn so much about the act of choosing. I think I return to sculpture because of how much I'm sort of trying to conjure an empathic response. And I feel like the experience of being in a body in the third dimension, this density. So often we feel stuck in sort of the science of it all and the limits of this third dimension. And that when I approach a sculpture, when I approach the three-dimensional form, I feel like I'm practicing transforming reality. And in that, it's empowering. Because I think, you know, I can't do that. I'm limited by my skills, my tools, my imagination. And so when I link that sense of wonder and exploration outside of the comfort zone of witnessing and start exploring what I'm able to do with my body, the physicality of sculpture is so inspiring and I think transformational. Aside from the very fact that you're transforming matter into object, but also transformational psychologically, spiritually, by what traditionally was like a leadership position, even like a supernatural leadership position, or Catholicism and what it brought to the Southwest. And I've always been satisfied by the fact that in the Southwest, Catholicism had this large mother figure and then the really small Jesus figure, right? And the priorities being matriarchal. I watch and I go, like you learn a lot about people by what they do with other people, even if it is an icon, right? I think that we look to icons because we're trying to understand our own greatness, our own strength. And when we see greatness and strength and power in other people, something's resonating in ourselves. And we want to so badly believe in our magic, in our influence, in our ability to make change, and also to be in a state of faith or peace. Even celebrities, like, we look to beauty, we look to talent, we look to those things that are inspiring because, you know, we're all pieces of each other in a sense, and so we're looking for that part in our own experience and vibration of humanity, you know? I've been trying to sit with isness, and isness is a space of like, it is, right? And it helps me navigate some of those hard feelings, I think. That isness, I keep thinking about an empty chair, and empty chair being so powerful. Because it has a role, but it doesn't necessarily do anything. And it is incredibly beautiful, allowing of is, right? It's like, it just is. It's being. And so when I think about things like icons, or I think about art, I think about action, of this taking action in a sense. Isn't it wonderful that we can admire something? Isn't it wonderful that we desire? Isn't it wonderful that we are humans and we go through our challenges and we look so much for things, and having sort of compassion for myself when I get stuck on reading the news, you know? I like open my phone and it's like a beautiful day and I started reading the news, you know? And instead of like, oh, you're so bad for reading the news, like you wasted your day, or you're not doing the right things in the world, or like, oh, things are so horrible and you're not making enough change, you know, and just sort of simply go, huh, that happened. And you know, this is sort of recent, and I think it's helping me deal with some big changes in my life. And if you don't just sit with things, things will really mess with your head. I recently was invited to be in the Whitney Biennial, and that's a really special experience. I'm also opening a large public installation at Madison Square Park, which is 18-foot tall steel figures with bronze elements, the central figure. And I just got back to New Mexico from installing, which was like cranes and lots of people. And, you know, Madison Square Park is not a very quiet place. It's very busy. And I was thinking so much about the energies, be it our thoughts or even the amount of physical labor that goes into bringing art into the world. And if I'm not careful, they can consume me. And I think that about icons, and it's full circle to icons, that individualism, it's consuming, and I don't want to get consumed by it. And I have to be very careful, because our world likes to offer us bait to be consumed by individualism. And so I feel like I'm being offered lots of challenges to find grace in moments where the thought beings can start attacking, right? And the thought beings start wanting to be in control of everything. And I'm like, shh, shh, shh. Huh, where's that empty chair? Because really, in the end, it's a very simple thing. You know, I like to feel like my matter, my actual physical being, is a rock. It's just a piece of the matter of the world and has vibration in it, but so does everything else. And I'm just in this world with everything else. And in that way, I'm not trying to control it. I'm just more witnessing it. You know, and a lot of my work is sort of about teaching me that. I've seen so much of my self-worth as how much I can do, actually achieve and accomplish, and how hard I can work. And so I've taken the arms off of a lot of my pieces and sometimes replaced them with necklaces for the very reason of maybe it's time to just be. Maybe the work is actually release, letting go, and being in a state of allowance and witness rather than action and judgment.
Totally. But I'm also interested in this idea that your works have this connection to sort of the ancient world as well, and ancient stories, you know, works that you title such as Genesis, where you envision a mother and her child. I mean, I'd love to know about sort of why you play on these ancient stories as well, because when we think of something like Genesis, already just from the world that we grew up in, we have a sort of preconceived idea of what Genesis was, but actually Genesis is something totally different altogether.
So back to like limits. I come from a tribe in northern New Mexico, a pueblo, a Tewa village, that was colonized a long time ago, right? When the Spanish conquistadors came up this way. And what we learned early on is certain things don't get shared, because if you share them, they'll be used against you, especially cultural belief systems or religious practices. And so because of that, a lot of the pueblos are very conservative with their culture, ceremonies, etc. And it was a preservation technique, and it worked. So, you know, because of their conservative nature and the closed nature of ceremony and tradition, a lot of those things have been preserved through the centuries that could have been lost or given away or corrupted in lots of ways. And so because I grew up a part of this community and understanding what could happen if you disrespected that kind of knowing, you know, you don't do that. You don't make that stuff, right? So here we are growing up in the Pueblo, and you come from a family of creators and artists, and yet you can't make certain things, things that don't belong out there, that are no one else's business. And I really love boundaries. Like, I've been really learning a lot about thresholds, about boundaries and of self-respect. And actually, when you say, you know, that's not for everybody, that actually can be a self-loving thing, a community-loving thing, a relational-loving thing. You know, we come from a world that we feel entitled to have access to everything, especially with the internet and stuff. I'm just going to Google it and I'll have all the information on that person or that place or those people. And sometimes, you know, I think it's good to be like, no, you can't, and that's okay. And you have to sit with, no, that's not my business, and that's okay. And so my work had to be innovative in that I had to find other ways of expressing what I was trying to express or find without using some of those stereotypable, exotifiable mores in my work. And find another way to express things and to say, yeah, I might be from this community and that's important to me and it builds who I am and sort of the language that I use. But I also have to find a language that is bigger than this, that is dig to sort of the root of who we are as humans on this planet, and not just me, but all of us. And so I think the ancestry that you're kind of referencing is that investigation into the source of who we are. I've always been caught by othering and stereotyping and objectifying, right? Like, so what makes us other somebody else? What makes us look at them and say, you're different, and now we don't know something in common, or I can treat you differently because I don't empathize? And I feel like the more that I look for and identify pieces of that humanity, the more inclusive it is. Like, I've always played around with this idea of, like, really, really, like, realistic painting, right? Like, photograph.
Photorealism.
Photorealism, right. Yeah. Thanks for the words. It's incredible, but it's actually exclusive. Because it's hard to relate to something that's so, so, so specific. Oh, really severe abstraction is also exclusive because it's so abstract that it's hard to relate to, right? And I'm always looking for the place where it's not so specific that it's exclusive and not so abstract that it becomes inaccessible. Like, how far can you push into that really sweet spot? And I feel like that accessibility is deep inside of all of us. And I think it has to do with the piece seeing you or there being a relationship. Like, how do you open this moment for relationship? Rather than I am the piece of art and you're looking at me. That's kind of how it's been, like you're here to judge or to build a perspective or an opinion about the art. Instead, it's like, what if the art is looking at you? We're in this moment. We're like, yo, you see me, I see you. And in this moment, we're building that which builds, and where we all come from is relationship, is ancestry. I think that's where that all comes from. I have to answer your question.
You totally did. I mean, it's interesting you should talk about ancestry as well, because not only in your community, but also that it's so significant that you come from a very long line of female sculptors and ceramicists. That sort of fascinates me in the sense that, you know, what was the kind of role of art and sculpture when you were growing up? And I mean, it must just be an extension of your fingers since you were a child.
When I was in graduate school, it was the first time I think I really realized that I was blessed with that family. Because to start with, I was built with a neural pathway that this was normal. You can support yourself, and you can make a life in relationship to clay. And a lot of people that I went to graduate school for ceramics. And, you know, they were struggling with the internal belief system that said you're supposed to be a lawyer, doctor, something else, right? And so to start with, I think that's an incredible blessing, but also that creativity was in everything in my family, right? So, you know, my mom is a sculptor and she's also a farmer and a builder. And so I grew up farming, building, and then she would wander into her studio and put on a movie and work on a sculpture, right? And it was seamless. There was no, like, this is the end of day, and this is when creativity starts. It was like creativity is absolutely every part of the day. Like it's applied in all things. And so I think that I didn't really understand the separate nature of art from life. And I think that is the very thing that was gifted down through the generations. And also I think about clay. She's also part of our family. You know, she's not. Yes.
She's the thread for all of you.
Yeah, and she's someone we've all built relationships with in all of our own ways. And she is so close to all of us, right? We're all in a very, very tight relationship to this family member, Clay. I didn't realize how much just watching my mom, my grandma, my aunties, everybody in my family working in clay. It's like when little kids watch their parents walk and you say, oh, that's how it's done. And you don't ever have to learn something. It just sort of came with the package, right? You know, I love metal. I love wood. I love all kinds of things. I love cars. But I return to clay. Clay is home. I'm so grateful for the confidence I have in our relationship.
It's so interesting that you should say that clay is this thread for all the women in your family or your family members also, because I love this work of yours called Seventh Generation that is made from clay, but is all these heads.
I mean, our food was grown in the earth. Our houses are built out of the earth. Our livelihood came from the earth. We are of the earth. Earth is our mother, really, truly, right? So then, of course, we look like her, right? So then I make representations of us, like we're all those children. And in a sense, you know, I am bringing into creation through my physical being more of her children, right? Like those are the sculptures. Those are those representations of beings that are coming through, and I don't know what they're here to do, really. Like I'm here to listen and just do my work, do my job, right? And my job is to witness and allow and have faith and also to provide the guidance, right? To also be a guide. Like I think about being a parent, right? You want to give your kid lots of free will and find their own way in the world, but you gotta grab them if they're gonna run into a street. Where is that nice, tender balance where love is boundaries as well? Love looks like a flow state, and it also looks like the moment where you bring it all together. Like my work, you know, the clay in its raw form isn't in a physical body, right? It's not in its form. And it's up to me to guide it. That's all I'm doing is guiding it. And then I also have to consider that I have these gifts of resources, of clay, of metal, etc., and I am using fossil fuels to fire that, and I want their voice to go far. And so I need to engineer them to exist for a long time. Like I don't want them to break right away. I don't want them to disintegrate or have planned obsolescence. I want them to be strong. And so part of that is also engineering. And that's like, oh, I'm going to weld you this like structure so that you stand for a long time. Like that's my job as a parent to give them strength and longevity.
Totally. I think it's so beautiful. I mean, obviously, you received your BFA at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Then you completed an MFA in ceramics at RISD. But I'm also fascinated that you have an MFA in creative nonfiction writing. What does this mean? And how did this influence your practice? And did it make you think differently about storytelling?
When I was at RISD, I was looking for a text on Indigenous aesthetics that I could reference and when I wrote my thesis. There's some incredible writing out there by Indigenous scholars, but nothing that was really what I needed. I ended up using Japanese aesthetics, relational aesthetics, to try and describe what I was trying to get at, right? So I decided I was going to go to school for creative nonfiction and write that text so that there would be that reference for future me's down the line. And it was an incredible experience because I ended up co-teaching a seminar with my brother, who is a professor in Indigenous liberal studies. He's a historian. We taught a seminar on Indigenous aesthetics, and I brought in the art creative expression side, and he brought in the historical reference around Native expression. In the conversation with the students in that class, we realized that you really can't explain Indigenous aesthetic in the language of the colonizer. You can't do it referencing Foucault. Like even this idea of aesthetic and art as separate than life and all those things doesn't make sense at all. And here I was, a semester into my creative nonfiction degree, like hell-bent on doing this, and then I was kind of tossed in the wind as to where I was going to go with that. And Sherman Alexie is a writer, and he was at the program, the Institute of American Indian Arts, and he told me that I am expressing that Indigenous aesthetic, that it is my artist statement. He said, why don't you write an artist statement, but don't write it in the language of the colonizer. Write your artist statement based on the way that we write our belief systems. And that is through story. And that is through experience. It's not direct. It's holistic. And so my thesis was a collection of short nonfiction essays, which I find really interesting because I'm really caught by fiction and nonfiction. And the fact that fiction is creating a world and nonfiction is translating a lived world. And yet when you live in a world that includes the magic, includes supernatural, includes story, how does that all flow together and where does it begin and end? But I really think that my writing is helpful because I think I'm a really, a conceptual person, even though I'm not so much in lots of ways that I really dig. I love to read. I love to, I'm always investigating, and I feel like writing is another way of flexing the muscle of listening. Because as much as you're speaking in that moment of writing, you almost have to let go of something in order to let something else speak through you. That's another practice that's super important when it comes to listening. I really appreciated that opportunity to get that master's and, you know, the feedback. And also the Institute of American Indian Arts is a very special place. And it was important for me to build community there. And Tommy Orange and Trudy Smile and people that were in that same program or participated in that community, you know, doing incredible things. And so it's really beautiful because I feel like the more tools we have of expression, then the more refined we can be with that voice, even though it looks different forms. Yeah.
I think that's so perfect, the way that you put that. And I'm also very interested in the relation that you have, I guess, to the outdoors as well, and stones and prehistory. I mean, here in England, you know, we sort of live in a country based around ley lines and stones that have a lot of spiritual and significant meaning. And I noticed that one of your works is called Cairn, which is a title that takes its name from a word that means a human-made pile of stones raised for a purpose. So for example, in prehistoric times, it would be because of a trait forming piles of stones as markers of memorials or burial monuments. I mean, how does a work like Cairn speak to this idea of prehistory and the kind of landscape?
That work was really inspired initially by becoming a parent. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. And my daughter is the piece I'm most proud of. But there is such a vulnerability in the balance around guiding, right? I felt like as a mother, I had to remember that now I am marking the path. And in that is the balancing of stones. And I am only a link in this generational story. And the responsibility when it hits you is, I'm like, oh no, you know? I mean, I remember when I realized, like, oh, I'm an endangered species. And if I don't have kids and raise them to know culture and language, then I am personally complicit with the ending of my people. What kind of responsibility is that? It's terrifying because when you're a kid, you think, oh, there's elders and they're the ones doing it. And then all of a sudden, at a certain point, you realize, oh no, it's now on my shoulders, right? I have to make those decisions and I have to be that responsible one. And it's like in a cairn, there's a stack of stones and, you know, it'll all fall down if you don't hold your part, if you don't stay balanced. It's really terrifying in lots of ways. And it's also humbling, that individuality that we are so comfortable in almost becomes not important, right? And you have to be like, oh, those things that I really wanted to do, all of a sudden, you know, does it benefit the future generations? And does it honor the past generations? How am I being a good ancestor and how am I being a good descendant simultaneously in this moment? And it changes because sometimes we value one thing more than the other. But I think that really, truly, it sifts down to being conscious and aware of your values and putting those forward first, full circle, back to listening. So in that moment of listening, when we listen long enough, then we are informed. And if you're informed, then you make a more informed decision. And that more informed decision will hopefully be a healthier one. And one that was not as informed because we didn't take the time to listen. And that research may not be online or in conversation, but that research may be in silence. That research may be asking a rock to tell you which way to go, and then figuring out how to listen to its answer. And that's information that's being informed. Rocks are so important to me. They teach me so much. And I didn't know that Europe, or the place where you're coming from, has to do with these rock formations. And it makes a lot of sense. That talk about ancestry, you know, I'm humbled by the ancestry in the rock, you know. And I'm also caught by my own entitlement to think I could move it. I remember my brothers were running in the hills when I was a kid, and they would pick up rocks and throw them. And I would stop and I'd crouch on the ground and start crying. And they would say, "Why are you crying?" And I said, "Well, it may never, ever see its friends ever again. Did you ask it if it was ready to go? Was it able to say bye to the rocks that it was around for who knows how long?" Right? I would be so like distraught about it. Right? Like, did you ask the rock if it wanted to be thrown? And then I would get picked on.
I'd love to also ask you about Maria. Maria is a car and an artwork and named in honor of Native American artist Maria Martinez, who lived from 1887 to 1980. I mean, tell me about this work that you call a power object.
You know, every single year, I feel like I have the answer to why I like cars. And then it changes. Like right now, the first thing that comes to mind is mothering. I grew up in sort of the boonies, so like you need a car to get places. And so I bought my first car when I was 12.
12?
Drove myself to driver's ed at 14.
No way.
Got my full license. Yeah, I've had long relationship with cars and they've been very important to me. As objects of power, I feel like in a world where I felt vulnerable, that they provided this turtle shell. They provided safety and transportation. And I feel like I projected this idea of love onto cars. And I felt loved by cars. As much as I love cars, I felt loved by them. And so right now, and when you ask me that question, I think that I'm sort of looking for a mothering kind of feeling. I have lots of cars. I worked on lots of cars when I'm expressing my love in different ways, fixing them up so they drive, making them strong, making them powerful, making them beautiful. And then I have aesthetic experiences. Good Friday in Española, New Mexico, is when there's lots of pilgrimages to a santuario de Chimayo. So lots of walkers are taking their prayer to the santuario. And then in the afternoon and the evening, everyone takes out their lowriders, their custom cars. And it takes about 4 hours to drive through a very short, maybe half mile, three-quarter mile town. Because there's so many cars, right? And so it's an aesthetic experience. It's applied aesthetics. And how that aesthetic experience transforms you. I grew up in the lowrider capital of the world. And I saw pride. I saw people having an aesthetic moment where they were feeling full of the bliss of beauty and applied intention around these cars. And I wanted that. And so I went to school for automotive science and auto body specifically. And I found an 85 Chevy El Camino, fixed it up. It was all bashed up. I did all the body work. I painted her like a vessel, like a pot, because an El Camino has like a car front and a truck bed in the back. And the truck bed is kind of rounded at the front. And so it looked like a vessel to me. And so I painted her with the satin hot rod black. And then I put a gloss clear over it to have the same aesthetic sort of style as our traditional pottery from the area. And Maria Martinez was from San Ildefonso Pueblo, which is the Tewa tribe directly south of us. But the black carbon reduction firing that turns red clay into a deep black is common in this area for my tribe and hers. But it was her and her partner that figured out the style that you can polish the clay really, really, really shiny. And then if you paint over that polish with a clay slip, that it'll create the pattern very subtly. That's only in the reflection versus the matte of the surface of the clay. And so I did that with the car, and I put sort of traditional pottery designs on the car. And she's of this place. She is meant for cruising on Good Friday. As she drives along this river in between these two mountain ranges, she reflects the world around her in her paint job. And that paint job is geometric depictions of our natural world. So it represents mountains, it represents water and wind, it represents this place. And so she's painted with place. And as she drives in that reflection in her being, it's about self-love, it's about power, it's about autonomy in relationship, being of place and really soaking it in. I'm not driving her today because she is currently at the North Carolina Museum of Art.
Oh no!
She goes to another museum after that, but I have other cars. They need love too. She can't get all the love.
Rose P. Simpson, thank you so much. We do always have a question that we ask all of our guests at the end of the podcast. It is, if you could meet any woman artist from now or from history, who would it be and what would you say to her?
It's a good segue because I would have loved to have met Maria. I would have told her thank you, but she's still here. She's still in the clouds and in the stars and the mountains. I'm so grateful to share this life with all these incredible women artists.
Thank you so much, Rose, for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me, for sure, for sure.
Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of the Great Women Artists podcast with the fantastic Rose B. Simpson. If anyone is in the San Francisco area, do not miss Rose's fantastic sculpture, which is now up at the De Young Museum. This episode was sound edited by the brilliant Nada Smiljanic, and thank you all so much for listening to this episode of the Great Women Artists podcast with me, Katie Hassel.